Sahana vavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastama vidvishavahai. Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sarigaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Okay, yama, restraints. To fulfill the above conditions, Patanjali Yoga begins by describing an ethical code designed to calm one's relationship with oneself and others. The first two limbs of Patanjali Yoga, the yamas and niyamas, consist of 10 concomitants that constitute this code. 10 concomitants, yeah, that constitute this code.
Commitments?
Huh?
Commitments?
Oh, commitments. Yeah, commitments. Okay. Better than concommitments. Where did I get the yen? Wow. That's pretty good. Was I pulled that in from the previous? Oh, because con is in the next word.
Oh.
Or it's in the word before that.
We also had some concommitants earlier in this time.
Yeah, yeah. No, it just means that you just pull those things and put them in the one. The five yamas, restraints, are non-violence, ahimsa, truthfulness, satya, non-stealing, asteya, celibacy, brahmacharya, and non-possessiveness, parigraha. They replace animalistic urges with saintly virtues, and thus break the four legs of adharma, sinful life, which stands on meat-eating, counteracted by ahimsa, illicit sex, counteracted by celibacy outside of procreation within marriage, gambling, counteracted by truthfulness, and intoxicated, counteracted by self-restraint. Ahimsa. Ahimsa literally means non-injury or non-violence. Generally, one thinks of non-violence as merely restraining from the physical act of violence. But in yoga scriptures, non-violence is to be practiced in thought, speech, and action, right? In all three. Otherwise, then sometimes it might be non-violent in one aspect, but violent in another. Like when speaking, one may be very harsh, right? Or the thoughts are very harsh, right? You know, you give that nice grin, you know, when the person, you know, the guy's not that annoyed, you give that nice grin, but in your mind, you're thinking of all kinds of amazing things, earth opening up, the falling inside, you know, all these kind of things are happening, but you don't do that. Like that. So he's mentioning he replaces the animalistic urges, so this is what starts human life, right? That's the idea. Human life begins with this. So that the yoga system is just like any of the, in the culture, the Vedic system, is that the culture starts with these basic qualities, right? So human life begins with this. So they're simply doing the same process because you're not going to be doing many other things, right? Basically, you're just going to be dealing in the ashram and getting and adjusting with the asanas and everything like that. You're not going to be moving around in society, running successful business and all that. Not if you're doing the Patanjali, Sangha yoga system, right? You know, like that. Satya. According to Patanjali yoga, one should be truthful to oneself and to others in thought, speech, and action. The yoga student is taught to speak what he thinks and to do what he says. Sometimes one lies without awareness, or sometimes just for fun, or for the sake of creating gossip. These simple lies are like seeds that create habits that will one day become one's nature. Thus one cannot even trust in himself because of his untruthful nature. Mm-hmm. The day a person becomes totally truthful, his whole life becomes successful, and whatever he says or thinks comes true. Mm-hmm. He gains inner strength through which he overcomes all fear in his life. Right, so this is just on the mundane platform, the platform of just on piety, right? Mm-hmm. But the actual, so on that platform of piety, that will work. If you always speak truth, right, then you'll always get the proper results. Right, in the way of what you say will come true and all that. It doesn't say people will like you. It just says like that. So here is also truth means for within what is in the cultural context. Right. In other words, you're not lying just for fun or not lying because you have some motive that you're trying to get. You just don't do those things. Yes.
And it doesn't mean saying everything that's fact.
No, it doesn't mean saying everything that's within the mind. That's generally what's taken as nowadays, is truth means whatever I feel or think, I just do. So I'm true to myself, but true to what part of yourself? The animal side. So that's not actually truth either, right? Because the soul's not supposed to be doing that.
Yeah.
So... But the actual point is truth means it's connected to Krishna. So what is actually useful for Krishna consciousness, what's beneficial for Krishna, that's truth. Mm. All other things are, you know, mundane truth. It's nice, it's pleasant, you know. Mm. It's nice social interaction, but it's not actually real. It doesn't have real substance. So that's where you're dealing, if you're dealing on the yoga system just on the mundane platform, then that you get that mundane benefit. But if you want the spiritual benefit, then you have to actually perform it on the transcendental platform, which means it's connected with transcendence. Right? Okay. Overcomes all fear in life, because fear is fear of loss. Right? So if one's thinking one will lose something, then one is careful and lies. Right? So whatever it is, it may be it planned in that way, it may be in a dynamic, you know, outgoing way, or it may be something in where one is, not sure of oneself, or any of these things, it doesn't matter. But that's the position one's taking because of fear. But if one understands I'm not this body, I'm servant of Krishna, and I do everything for service to Krishna, that fear is automatically taken care of. Why? Because it's satya. Mm. It's real truth, yes.
There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's 17:15, which says that one should be truthful and speak pleasantly.
Yes.
As well, how does that work?
Means you're taking it that truth is not nice.
Sometimes it's not.
Yes, but you can say it nicely.
Okay, right.
You know what I'm saying? That's all. You can say it pleasantly. You know. Thinking of an example, but
it's minefield.
So it's just you can pleasantly tell somebody that, you know, they're a rat bag and everybody else thinks they're a rat bag. You know? Of course, you know, I mean, you look at the positive side, you are the best rat bag around. But of course, you know, it's not improving your people's appreciation and all that. So if you'd be less of a rat bag, then people would probably like you more. You know, look at the positive side, you know. Does that make sense? Yeah, so you can say it nicely. It means you find what's useful for the situation. But the point is ultimately that's truth, meaning what are the facts. But the ultimate point is what does that truth, that fact, have to do with actually Krishna consciousness? So the point is if it's not valid in Krishna consciousness, not actually valuable as truth. You know what I'm saying? So that's where the mundane comes to its end, and the spiritual then. So you have to see it in that way, because sometimes by not telling mundane truth, it will be better for the actual Krishna consciousness. Does that make sense? Because Krishna consciousness is not dependent upon karma. So it doesn't necessarily mean it needs a nice situation for it to function.
Can you give an example?
Let's say the person is chanting Hare Krishna. He thinks he's really good at chanting Hare Krishna. He's very dynamic. He's always there and everything like that. But he's got an attitude and all that. So the point is, by just telling him that, you know, he's got so much attitude and he's actually pretty useless at chanting, then now he may give up the chanting. So it's better he's chanting. You know what I'm saying? So you have to see what's actually going to be useful in the service.
That's interesting.
You understand? Because, see, you have different layers of how big you're looking at the picture. Let's say you're trying to get some work done. And by saying the truth, then it may correct one little part, but then the bigger part doesn't get done. But by not saying that, then the bigger thing gets done. So which is the better? So therefore, one has to also understand the culture of saying things in such a way that your point gets made, but at the same time it may not be so obvious. Does that make sense? So this is all just part of, you know, the culture. Because the point is it's not just black and white. You know, if it was, it'd be very easy. You know, that time. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, asteya. Asteya, a non-stealing, provides a great opportunity for the practice of non-attachment and non-possessiveness. Actually, non-stealing is a negative explanation of contentment. Because when one is self-satisfied, he's not tempted to desire others' things. Such a person considers whatever he has is sufficient and does not allow himself to be enslaved by lust and greediness in order to attain desired objects by illegitimate means. The yoga system advises that non-stealing be practiced mentally, verbally, and physically. An honest author writes original thoughts, and if some material is borrowed from other, the author honestly and respectfully gives references. That is an example of non-stealing at the thought level. In the same way, non-stealing practiced at every level of the personality helps maintain purity of life. And purity of life allows one to shine and grow in all dimensions. So, okay. Okay, so it's pointing out that the non-stealing and the yama then is the other side of contentment that's in niyama. Right? Yes.
That means that from this we can see that you can never be content as an atheist.
Not really.
Not really.
No. It means you may have, by practice and that very great development of some qualities, due to previous proper activity, that you may be able to use to some degree, but ultimately it won't, because your purpose is material.
Mm.
So ultimately the whole thing will fall apart, because it means, in other words, the basis of the whole thing is false anyway. Right? It means, the point is I'm saying, I'm not stealing someone else's stuff.
Mm.
I'm content with what I have. But what I have, who does it actually belong to?
It is Christmas.
It belongs to God. So if we're not recognizing that, we're actually stealing. Exactly. But it's socially acceptable stealing.
Yeah.
Right? Like if I go over, I'm building some new furniture, I go next door to your house, cut down your tree and bring it back, and you know the carpenter comes over and makes it into furniture, there's a problem. Right? But if I go out into the forest and cut down the tree and bring it back, then no one says anything. Mm. So somehow or another, I can't take from my neighbor, but I can take from God, right? So, you know, it doesn't, you know, it, right? You know. So, yes.
I was just thinking, is it possible at all to take something which is not according to our karma, it doesn't belong to us? Can we actually grab it?
Means the point is you would have to have the karma that you could take it, but it doesn't mean that authorizes you to take it. You know, let's say, you know, just as a gross example, I want to, you know, take something off the table, but I don't have any arms, right? So it'll be really hard, right? You know, I can maybe grab my teeth, but then when you ask me what am I doing, it'll be a really problem to explain it. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So it's not going to be very practical. So the point is, I don't have the karma to take things, right? But if you have hands, you can take things. So you have the karma that you could take it, but then by taking it, then in the future you'll have the karma that you can't take things. You know, does that make sense? In other words, you always have that choice. But at the same time, it's just like, you can. If I have no money, I can't gamble it. But if somehow or another I get some money, then I could gamble it. But the gambling's never good. But it's just, you had some karma to get money, but then gambling is a separate thing. Does that make sense? All these different, having facility is one thing, how you use the facility is another. So if I get the facility because of proper action, but if I misuse the facility, then I'll lose that facility in the future. Does that make sense? Let's say I have some friends and they're close and they, you know, they talk everything. So then I find out, you know, where they keep their money, the this, that. Then I go and steal it. So that means in the future I won't have friends that are that intimate. You know what I'm saying?
In other words, can we say it like that, that the money that I steal, I would get it anyway, but just by proper means?
You could, but you could also say, is that someone else's quota and you don't deserve to have it in that way? You know what I'm saying? In other words, the capacity to be able to steal something is there, but whether you should have that means, in other words, you do the proper work, you can have that. You know, so it's like what you're saying. It means like, okay, I go to work, I work for 3 months, and then I get that money. Or I can just take it out of, you know, somebody's bag. Mm-hmm. Like that. Mm-hmm. But it's not specific. I wouldn't connect it specifically like that. You know, because then there's the element, well, I would get it anyway, but this is just a quicker way, or it was an emergency, or, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's more of... Means there's one thing, you have the capacity to do something, but it's not that you should be doing it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Just like I'm walking by the office, you know, like that. You know, the room's full of all the, you know, the people in their little cubicles like that. And then, you know, the boss has stepped out, you know, and everyone's having a bit of a joke. And so I walk by the office and then, you know, it's a glass thing and everything. So then I stop for a moment, you know, and go into the office, you know, like that. And everybody's watching and I sit in the chair, sit back, put my figure on the table, you know, do all kinds of things that are, you know, typical of the boss. Everyone's laughing and everything. But I shouldn't be doing that, but I can do it. You know, but it's not that, well, I have the karma to be the boss. You know what I'm saying? I have the karma to make everybody laugh. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I'm saying you have all these multiple things working at once. That's why karma is so difficult to understand. That's why dharma is so difficult, because you have everything work functioning at once. So somebody may have the, means he's a thief, but he's from stealing, now he doesn't have the karma to be able to steal, so even if he tries, it doesn't work. You know, but that's by he's misused that. Okay, he's taken something, let's say there was an emergency, so he took it, then that's something you can work out. But it wasn't an emergency, he took it, then that's not good. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So you have all those kind of... Because otherwise, then you get the thing, well, it's my karma to get it anyway, I'm just getting it earlier. You know, Christmas came early. You know, so then... But you don't want to start stuff like that, so you have to be careful.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because the mind latches on to stuff like that really fast. And, you know, even if you have a crowbar, it doesn't want to let go. So better not to let it... catch those things in the first place. Otherwise...
So this is to do with how reactions get grosser and grosser as we fail to recognize. I mean, we may have the karma.
Ten, because subtle turns into gross, but it means that there has to be the subtle in the first place.
Mm.
You have that, you have, is like you mentioned, lust and greediness, therefore, right? Even if lust is there but not greediness, or greediness, then you may be able to use it. When all that comes together, then there's a problem. You know, you want it and you want more than what you deserve. Because greed means you just want more and more. You don't need more and more.
Yeah, you just...
But you want. You know. So, that, you know, what to do. You know, it's like, you know, most families get by with one car, but, you know, rich families, they have 15 cars, but it's still not enough. You know, it's just, you know, where does it, how does it work?
Yeah.
I mean, where was it? I think Versailles, I think it's 1,000 rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't need, two people don't need 1,000 rooms, right? You know, like that. But they have 1,000 rooms, you know, like that. One room is just for the clock. That's all. That's it. You have this fabulous room, all, you know, gilded and everything. And in the middle, there's a marble pillar, and on the pillar, there's a clock. So you want to know the time, you go there. Like that, you know. So each.
It takes about 20 minutes to get to the clock.
Yeah, okay, so. Like that. So you, I guess you send someone to go and look at the clock.
What's the time?
Yeah, no rush, yeah. And the amazing thing, there's 1,000 rooms, there's not one toilet. There's no toilets in Versailles. Work that one out. What to do? Okay. So in other words, if there's truth, then there is one the development of the personality, the purity, right? You know, all aspects develop. So that's the thing. So you see these sages who are very effulgent and very progressive, that's because they follow this non-stealing, right? Like that. Brahmacharya. Brahmacharya literally means to act in Brahman. One whose life actions are always executed in the consciousness of I am not the body is called a brahmachari. The word brahmacharya is commonly translated as sexual abstention, but celibacy is only a partial explanation of this word. Sexual continence is in itself is not the goal. The goal is to control the senses in order to achieve deeper levels of inner awareness. Because right, otherwise it's taken brahmacharya is just to be celibate. But actually celibacy, the purpose of that is to be more aware so that you can become more advanced in God consciousness. That's the actual point. Right? Patanjali Yoga takes brahmacharya in a wider sense to mean selectively performing only those activities that are helpful in achieving the highest goal of life. Right? Mm-hmm. So we, as yogis, we would also take it in that way. But it also has its more social meaning, that means abstention from sex life, right? So, yeah. So that's, yeah. But at the same time is then if it's applied specifically just for procreation and yeah. Is it? Yeah. Then it also applies brahmacharya, grihastha brahmacharya. It's the same principle, like that, because it's only for the purpose of Brahman, right? So it means if things are according to the Shastra and it's to please Krishna like this, then it works like that. Brahmacharya is possible only when the mind is free from all sensuous desires, especially the sexual urge, which is the most powerful and which can be most destructive if not directed and channeled properly. Illicit sexual activity dissipates vital energy that is to be utilized for the attainment of higher consciousness. For achieving this goal, the yoga system advises one to organize all his sensory forces and to utilize them in a proper and beneficial way. It teaches control of sensual cravings in order to attain that inner peace and happiness that is greater than all transient bodily pleasures. Uncontrolled senses weaken the mind, and a weakened mind has no capacity to concentrate in one direction or on one object, right? Because otherwise it's trying to go in every direction. What are the options, right? Means it goes in. The problem is it's focused in one place, but then there's so many places you could get sense gratification. So once it has the taste for sense gratification, it'll look in all these places for them. And then once it's looking in all these places, then it's distracted, right? Nothing gets done. You can't accomplish anything. So eventually it comes down to there, and then one gets frustrated. So there's no peace. Yes.
You have 5 stages of the mind.
Yes.
Can't get to one point, but it stays in that.
It'll always start, because one pointed means it has to be focused on Brahman. But as soon as it steps into the others, then immediately it's either distracted or disturbed. Yeah. Like that. If it focuses on nothing, then it's even like that. Because there are systems that use that just pure ignorance. That's their system.
Mindfulness.
Mindfulness. Mindfulness.
It's a very popular way of meditating on nothing. I mean, you're just concentrating on nothing.
But still, they're concentrating.
But here
we're talking about they're so ignorant that they're not even interested in doing anything.
Okay.
So you do have systems that do that. They're just so ignorant that they don't do anything. There's nothing, you know, in the mode of passion that they do.
Is that even a system?
It's a system. It's a tantric system. It's a really low-grade tantric system. But it works for those who are totally in ignorance.
Like that. Great.
Like that, you know.
So when people go crazy, means their mind can focus like on anything? Is
that can be, or it's just what they want, they can't get, so that unattainableness drives them nuts. It's, you know, that after frustration. In other words, when desire, lust, increases too much, and they can't actually, you can't balance the desire and the attainment, then you can go crazy. Okay. Person with a mind weakened by lust fails to think properly, to speak properly, or to act properly. Right? Because that was the thing before, is that the body, mind, and words are doing something beneficial. For higher attainment, one therefore has to withdraw his energies from the petty charms and temptations of sensory objects and convert the flow of the life force towards higher consciousness. It's amazing how you can put these nice words together. All you can just is that don't be attached. Right? Yeah. You can say it in such a nice, nice way, you know. Aparigraha, non-possessiveness, is generally misunderstood to mean denying oneself all material possessions, right? That's why we need definitions, because otherwise we'll take it that we'll take all these things in one particular way. Mm. When actually what it is because it's yoga system, that it's meant to connect oneself to the Supreme, right? But here they're connecting to a certain degree, right? Only to the Paramatma, you know, at best. But ultimately, we see generally to Brahman. So that it's not being brought to its fullest. So non-possessiveness means it's everything's for Krishna. So one can be dealing with so many things, but it's for Krishna, right? But the general tendency is to think non-possessiveness means you have nothing, right? So if you have anything, then you know what's the problem. Does that make sense? Mm. That's generally how it would be looked at.
Right.
Yes.
Can we say that in the beginning this is
good? In the beginning it can be, if it's a matter of, if the only way you can be non-possessive is to have nothing, then you start from there, right? But once you understand it's not yours, then you can have things to use in Krishna's service. Because otherwise if you have nothing, it's also your range of what you can do for Krishna is also more limited. That means, of course, you can sit down and chant Hare Krishna, absorb yourself in Krishna, but if we're talking about beginning stages, generally that's not happening either. So, does that make sense? So, it means that, yeah. So, you can see it even on a subtle level, like we give the example of the temple car, right? The temple car is because we're not attached, it's falling apart, but it's Krishna's, his should be the best. Right, it should always be taken care of because it's Krishna's car. Right, but that's the element of where this non-possessiveness comes in a negative way. We don't actually understand the meaning of it. Right,
if it's his car, he can take care of it.
I don't even think they go that far because then that at least then you're having some dialogue there. You know, you've opened some dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah. In that sentence, simple living, I think usually simple living is taking something very bare and like.
Yes. It means, generally simple living means, at least the American term was simple ton. Hmm. It means a very unsophisticated, you know, basically, I don't know what you would use, yokel or, you know, some kind of guy that lives out in the, say, sticks or boonies or, you know, something way out there. Not sophisticated, you know, basically should be covered from head to foot with cow dung, right? You know, and straw, you know, pitchfork. You know, pitchfork's good, like that. You know, but the point is, the simple means it's not complicated, like that. It doesn't mean that it's not more developed. It just means it's less complicated. Okay. But the word actually indicates an inward attitude rather than an outward behavior. Right? Because the ideas you're trying to go into the mind, go from the gross to the subtle, they all indicate a subtler element, all these. But they do have their external manifestation. Right?
Mm.
Right? In other words, if it's not necessary for your service, you wouldn't have it. Right? If it's necessary for your service, you have it.
Mm.
It's simple. The feeling of possessiveness is an expression of dissatisfaction, insecurity, attachment, and greed. One who strives his whole life to gain more and more worldly objects is never satisfied because that desire can never be quenched. Footnote 14. In Bhagavad Gita 2:70, the Lord says, "A person who is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled but is always still, can alone achieve peace, and not the man who strives to satisfy such desires. Right? So in other words, you can satisfy the desires by not actually worrying about them. Because desires will come. That's just the point is there's so many opportunities, so many options, so the mind is just catching those. So if you strive for them, you'll always be disturbed because there's unlimited things you can strive for. There's no end. Right? But if you don't get disturbed by them, it means they're coming but you don't worry about them, then you'll be satisfied. The mind will be peaceful. Right? So we'll take it, no, if I fulfill this one, then it'll be. No, but when you fulfill that one, you weren't satisfied. Right? Because otherwise you're saying, if I fulfill this desire, then I'll be satisfied, then I can peacefully sit back. But the point is that saying material endeavor can create satisfaction. Right? But it can't. So you'll perform that activity, you weren't satisfied. Then the point was I should be satisfied. So then it was, the way I did it this time wasn't quite right, that's why I wasn't satisfied. But if I make this adjustment and do it again this way, then I'll be satisfied. Right? And like that, we can spend our whole lifetime making those. That's the meaning of mental speculation. Right? Is you're speculating that it didn't work this way, so I can adjust it that way, then it'll work. Well, it didn't work that way, I can adjust this way, then it'll work. Oh, because I'm doing the wrong kind of it. If I do this activity, then it'll work. And that does it. And then you speculate within that again. You understand? It just keeps on going. So it can't be done. So therefore, the practice is just there, not being disturbed but by the water. Like the ocean is not disturbed. The water comes in from the river and it's still this peaceful. Right? Because why? It's bigger. And so what's bigger? Krishna consciousness. Right? That's always bigger than anything material. Srila Prabhupada explains in his purport, as long as one has the material body, the demands of the body for sense gratification will continue. Right? In other words, engaging the senses, the body is always going to do. It's made out of senses. That's what it does. Right? The devotee, however, is not disturbed by such desires because of his fullness. A Krishna-conscious man is not in need of anything because the Lord fulfills all his material necessities. Therefore, he is like the ocean, always full in himself. Desires may come to him like the waters of the rivers that flow into the ocean, but he is steady in his activities, and he is not even slightly disturbed by desires for sense gratification. Right? Because sense gratification means engaging the senses not connected to Krishna. So he's so busy engaging the senses connected to Krishna, where's the time for that? His life's complete. It's full. There's no need. That is the proof of a Krishna-conscious man, right? Because it's the same way as just like the non-possessive. It doesn't mean not having anything. Giving up sense gratification doesn't mean not engaging the senses. It just means not engaging them separate from Krishna. That is the proof of a Krishna-conscious man, one who has lost all inclinations for material sense gratification, although the desires are present. Because he remains satisfied in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, he can remain steady like the ocean, and therefore enjoy full peace. Right? So as long as the material body there, the material desires are there, but, you know, who cares? You know, does that make sense? Like you're sitting in, you know, a station somewhere. There's tons of people talking and this and that, but you don't care. You just do whatever you're doing. Right? There's so much that could interaction, but you're not worried about it. Does that make sense? So it's not a problem. The body is there, so the body brings in sensual things. And there to be whatever is useful, you engage in Krishna service. Like what's your within the realm of your duties, means opportunities are there for Krishna consciousness. So out of all the things that the mind gives, what are actual opportunities for Krishna consciousness? Within that, what is within your duties? And then within that, what would be appropriate in this situation? So that's what you do. And all the rest of them, you don't worry about. You're not worrying about them anyway. Right? So it's natural. You say, no, it's not natural. It's natural just to let it. You know, no, yeah. But then if it's natural, then it's also natural that the next animal is going to come along and decide they want it also. You know, that's also, if we want to be real natural, you know, then that also works like that. Because he remains satisfied in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, he can remain steady like the ocean and therefore enjoy full peace. Others, however, who want to fulfill desires even up to the limit of liberation, what to speak of material success, never attain peace. The fruit of workers, the salvationists, and also the yogis who are after mystic powers are all unhappy because of unfulfilled desires. But the person in Krishna consciousness is happy in the service of the Lord, and he has no desires to be fulfilled. In fact, he does not even desire liberation from the so-called material bondage. The devotees of Krishna have no material desires, and therefore they are in perfect peace. Right? So whatever desire they have, they're in connection with Krishna. So everything works very nicely. Right? So pure devotion means it's purely connected to Krishna, right? Mixed means it's partially connected to Krishna, partially to ourselves. So we're partially satisfied and partially not, right? So just with time, then we learn the difference between the two. So we focus more on what does satisfy and give up what doesn't, right? It's just a matter of practice. That's why it's a sadhana.
But satisfied means steady, right?
Satisfied, yes, steady. But satisfied means is that you don't have any need.
Whereas
right? You're full within oneself. It means you're is complete. It means whatever you have, that's enough. But this doesn't mean from the point of view of that, you know, one makes no endeavor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that it was sad. Oh, it doesn't matter. It's not like that. It's not on the mundane platform. It's a matter on the platform of that. You don't require anything, but there's plenty of service to do. Right? So you're always active, always busy, always developing, always improving, but it's not for sense gratification. That's the difference. One who is constantly greedy for more forgets that it is impossible to eat more than the stomach can hold. Than the stomach can hold, to sleep on more ground than the body covers, or to wear more clothes than the body requires. Mm. Never thought of that. Mm. Sleep on the ground more than it requires.
More.
What if you... Okay. Whatever one possesses that exceeds the essential requirements becomes a burden. And instead of enjoying it, one suffers in watching and taking care of it. Person who desires more than which is required is like a thief who covets that which belongs to others. Non-possessiveness does not mean that one should not plan for the future or that one should give away all one's money. It simply means that one should not be attached to what he has. An attitude of possessiveness excludes one from all that one does not have. But the practice of non-possessiveness expands one's personality, and one acquires more than he has mentally renounced. Right? It is said, the one who has nothing has everything. Mm. You know, that's the, you know, because it's like, because the point is, people try to have everything to be satisfied. And so the idea is the more you have, the more you'll be satisfied. But this person's satisfied, so that means technically he has everything. Mm. Because he doesn't require anything. So that's kind of the...
It doesn't make a distinction.
It doesn't make a distinction, but it's just how the energy works. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Says he's in the Baldwin way, and he's saying that he's practicing that from non-possessiveness. He says, even from the point of view of enjoyment, he can enjoy all the fields, and he can go around and walk around, but the farmer who has inherited the farm, he has a whole sadhana to do the farm.
Yeah, he has a whole anxiety. Yeah, true. True, true. He has to worry about the fences and about poachers and the rain and this and that. But you just walk through and it's nice. Yeah, so it's just like, it's just, it works on the other way.
This seems to be more. Masculine
quality
than the feminine
one? More
of a? Masculine quality? Because it's in
the means always you're going to have both aspects, because non-possessiveness will be the masculine quality, but the manifestation of non-possessiveness and the action of non-possessiveness is feminine. So they go together, because you can't appreciate non-possessiveness you know, the masculine aspect without the feminine manifestation. Does that make sense? So all these good qualities, then the forms of it that gain it, then that's always appreciated. So you see, the feminine nature always likes those things. That's why the feminine nature is comfortable, very comfortable in Dharma. Right? Because those are the forms that get those qualities that one's looking for. You know, if one's looking for wealth or security or this or that, those are gained through these forms. Right? Does that make sense? So the point is, this manifestation of anything, that's feminine. Action of things, that's feminine. If you're looking at it from the quality and that, you know what I'm saying? Who's performing the activity, that's the masculine position. Who the activity is directed at, that's the feminine position. You know, that's fine. Does that make sense? So, yeah. So it's not a problem. The point is it's a matter of it, you might find that the female practicing non-possessiveness will be comfortable not possessing more things. Does that make sense? The wider variety of things to be engaged in the Lord's service than, let's say, a male practitioner of non-possessiveness. Does that make sense? But the same principle can be there. Point is if we see it in relationship to Krishna, it doesn't matter how much is there. Does that make sense? Yeah. In other words, you have, I mean, just a practical example. The male in the family structure, he has his room like that. Now the woman can come into the room and do whatever she wants to enter the room, but basically it's his room. Right, so he can bring in things. It doesn't mean she doesn't take them and throw them out. Or whatever, he can bring things into that place. Right? But it does have that. But the rest of the house, that belongs to the woman. Right? So she has total control. So you can't just bring something in and put it wherever you want. He can put it wherever he wants in his room, and then you'll come in and adjust it and put it in the right place. Right? If it belongs there. Right? No? So the whole point is like, the house is for Krishna, right? The house is for Krishna, then it works. Right? Yeah.
So can we say at any stage of our life as a devotees, we're always happy, and for materialists, they're never happy?
Yes. You can say that. Materialists never can be happy. There's moments, because the modes of nature are there, when the goodness predominates and something, there's that, just, you know, everything works out right, whether you're looking at it from the astrological or so, this, that, or it just, everything kind of works out, and there's that moment, you know, but it's only a moment. It's like the, how you say, the example is given of, I think it's called Habudubu, right? It means you take a chair. Right? Put the person in the chair. Tie them to the chair. Take the chair, tie it onto a big, long, you know, pole. Then take the pole and put it on some kind of a, you know, balancing thing. And then put the other end of the pole with the chair and the person in it into the lake in the water. And so you keep them under there until you start to see bubbles coming up, right? And then you bring it out of the water, right? So they take a deep breath. As soon as they got the breath, you put them back in. So you just work out the balance. How much time is he out of the water? How much time is he in the water? So that's basically how it works. It's not talked about much because you don't want people to get upset and lose their inspiration. But that's the reality. You know, it's just in other words, it's just a breath so that you're inspired to keep on going. I mean, it has that moment, you know, something happened, the kids smiled, or, you know, the boss said that was a great job, something. So then now he goes back to, you know, his hard work. And yes, no?
So this is how much Maya gives us just to continue.
Yeah, because otherwise she didn't give you that much, then everybody would be, you'd have a whole universe full of living entities that weren't willing to do anything, you know?
I've always wondered why materialists don't end up there. I mean, it doesn't make sense for them anyway.
True. It means if you want to...
I mean, their philosophy is completely pointless. Our lack of philosophy. So why?
Meaning that everybody can.
Yeah, everything comes from random. I mean, no.
Oh yeah, so, no, that's.
So
a,
why be, are
but
you
they
doing
don't
anything?
Live. They don't live like that.
No.
Because they, you know, if you want money, you get a job. If you want, you know, you want to watch the television program, you have to push that little button on the remote that makes it come on. You know, it's not just random, you know,
no.
like that. So it's, you know, you want to eat potato chips, you have to actually have a bag of potato chips and actually open it, you know, and put them in your mouth, right? You know, it's not that, you know, so it's nothing's random. But somehow or another, they like to do it that way. It just makes it fun. It seems to be more of a French thing, kind of, the existential kind of, yeah, kind of, like that. They're the best at it, you know. And but at the same time, as you know, they always sit at the cafe and get the right drink and wear the right clothes, and you know, and the cafe's in the right part of town. You know, so they have it worked out. But at the same time, but it's fun to talk and just everything's random. I don't know. It seems to be a unique
feature.
Yeah, it's a unique feature.
Yeah.
Okay, niyamas. Observances. The five niyamas regulate one's habits and organize the personality. They consist of purity, saucha, contentment, santosha, austerity, tapas, self-study, swadhyaya, and surrender to the Supreme Being, Ishvara, pranidhana. These observances allow a person to be strong physically, mentally, and spiritually. Right? Because if you're doing things right, one may say, why physically? Because everything gross comes from subtle. So if the mind is strong, then physically that will work. Because if you're not doing anything destructive, it won't be destructive. The body won't get destroyed. Saucha. In the context of yoga science, saucha refers to both physical and mental purity. Physical purity protects the body from diseases, and mental purity presents mental energy from being dissipated. Physical purity can be achieved easily, but one has to pay close attention to purity of mind, which depends on spiritual thinking, mindfulness, and discrimination. Right? Because otherwise the mind just runs free, then it generally tends to run free to something stupid and get itself polluted. Right? You know, it's just the way that's what it does. Right? It's,
the question
was, you know, like if you let a kid go free, it's guaranteed, it's just a matter of time before it's trouble, right? Depending on the kid, it's more time, less time, you know. Some kids you got about 30 seconds. Others you have 5-10 minutes, you know. And if they're really nice, it's 20 minutes, half an hour, you know, something.
I have a godbrother who asked Jayadvaita Swami about independently thoughtful, and he just said, independently stupid.
Independently stupid.
Yes. Yes, he basically wanted to do his own thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's just, well, because it sounds great. If I'm independently thoughtful,
yeah.
So independence is great, thoughtfulness is great, put it together, it sounds great. But the point is with, as we pointed out before, without parampara, there is no independent thought that is useful. So then. The yoga system places great emphasis on developing purity of the mind because concentration and inward exploration are impossible without it, and because psychosomatic disease and emotional disturbance result from its absence. Okay. Because if one is, it means, in other words, if one has, emotionally disturbed, one can't focus, one can't contemplate, right? And if that has developed into something, how you say, that is a habit, an emotion that's out of place, but that it becomes consistent, then it becomes this psychosomatic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just always there. You know, they're always depressed, or always in anxiety, or always, you know, overly obsessive, or something. So it's just something that anybody would get here and there as it would come, but this is just, it's fixed.
Yeah.
Now the question could come, could you say no, but then that's better because now they're fixed in
their
position.
Fixed in
yeah, you know, instead of being unsteady and, you know, all these emotions, they're fixed in their emotion, right? So they're always crazy instead of occasionally crazy. Yeah. Santosha. Okay, so then That purity means the physical purity is there. The physical purity is there. It also has effect on the mental purity, right? Because the mind, coming from goodness, likes to be in a pure situation, right? So that includes the emotional purity, physical purity, right? Sensual purity. But the tendency by habit is not to be. So then if you can control that, then it means that if you can control your environment, then it makes it so much easier to control the mind. Mm-hmm. Because you have to be aware to control the mind. But to control the environment, you have to be aware. So it's easier to be aware of physical items than it is to be of mental items. Mm-hmm. So that's why the practice of the physical purity is important. Does that make sense? Yeah. Because we're looking at it from material to spiritual. Material means it's not pure. So there is no technically pure material situation. So the purity means those practices that create a bringing one closer to being God conscious. That's the actual point of them. So that's why the practices are important. Santosha. Contentment is a mental state in which even a beggar can live like a king. It is one's own desires that make one a mental beggar and keep one from being tranquil within. Contentment does not mean one should be passive or inactive, for practice of contentment must be coordinated with selfless action. See, that's the difficulty, is that if the contentment is not with the selfless action, then it can give rise to the mode of ignorance, because one does nothing. So in other words, one's contented for oneself, but one is always engaged to try to do things nice for Krishna. Mm. Right? That works. Because otherwise, this element comes up, and those who are active persons are always worried about contentment. Because if people are content, nothing gets done. Mm. Yeah. Right? Because that's always the anxiety. If people are content, if people are satisfied. Right? Because that's the point. If people are religious, are less inclined to waste their money. But people who are less religious have a tendency to think sense gratification and position and that will. So actually, economically, it's better if people are less religious. You understand? Because they're worried about this element of contentment. But the point is they don't waste it on little things, but they'll spend it on big things. So instead of having a million little junks around a little dinky house, they have less junk in a very big house. You know what I'm saying? You see these, they go for big houses, big this, big that. And because then, you know, it has the space and facility for doing. But they don't waste it on small things. Like that. So for those who are into those aspects of economics, then that's a problem. Right? Tapas. The word tapas literally means the generation of heat. A yogi who burns with the zeal for austerity is able to generate heat from within his body that keeps him warm and fit, even in the icy wastes of the Himalayas. Prabhupada mentions that in previous times, brahmacharis, they didn't, you know, for the winter, they still would just lay down on the veranda and just cover themselves with their chadar and go to sleep. Right? They didn't require beds and this and that, because they just had so much, because of the tapa, they had so much energy.
Didn't Radhanath Swami do that?
Maybe. I didn't read the book.
Sorry, but
not that I shouldn't read the book. No, I just haven't read the book.
Pretty much, you just.
I think we have the book, but I haven't read the book.
It's nice.
Okay. No, the point is the yogis do that. That's one of the things they do for practice. You go up and get yourself wet. It means it's freezing outside, and then you sit there and dry yourself out. You know, and when you get really good at it, they cover themselves with a wet blanket. Right? That takes a little bit more. And then just, you know, the energy and dry themselves out. So it's just one of the ways to spend your time.
Yeah.
I see Indians, when we go to Calcutta, for example, that's their practice. They just lay down. It's so freezing cold, and they lie down on the bricks or whatever. Yeah. Doubt about the tapas.
It means, is it tapasya to lay down on the bricks in the middle of Calcutta and sleep there at night? Would you call that tapasya?
Not at all. They also
not at all. You wouldn't call that austere.
It is.
Yeah, so the point is they get benefit from that. And because of, means they're forced to live that lifestyle. It's not by choice. But because they've done it, you get the benefit. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, let's say, you've done something wrong. So you're sent out, you know, in the backyard to mow the backyard and rake up the grass. Okay, so you're doing it only because you've done something wrong. But once you've done it, and if you did it nicely, then you get praise that you did a nice job. You understand? So they get benefit from that. So it is that it does have that element. And so then it does, but it's not by choice. So that's why it takes a very long time. They have to be like that a long time to get the benefit. While the brahmachari or the, you know, the yogi, then he gets the benefit very quickly because he's doing it on purpose.
No, I wanted to ask if they heat themselves also. That's what I wanted.
If they heat themselves also. It depends. You have to see if they are they shivering or not. You know, it's just after a while they get used to it. Just like animals, they get used to staying outside. It's not that it's warm necessarily, but you know, they survive like that. It means you can adjust. The body adjusts. It's like you do something and it hurts, but if you keep doing it, you get a callus and it doesn't hurt. You know, right? I've seen cooks. They go and I got a, you know, the pot. You have to get a cloth. They just come and pick it up. It's hot. It's boiling. The water's boiling. They just pick the pot up and put it down. Like that, I have to have a cloth, you know. But because they're always touching, the skin gets used to it and stuff. So they get used to it. So that's all. They just adjust. It's like the, you know, like the animals. They adjust. But as Mana was mentioning, because of doing that, they're actually getting pious credit, and in the future that will come across as having that facility. So now they have no facility. In the future, that means they'll have a nice facility. That's how samsara works, you know. You go, you know, you use the facility, you do properly, then you get the facility, you misuse the facility, then you lose the facility. And then from not having the facility, that austerity, then you get the facility. So like that, even if you do nothing, you know, specifically, you'll just keep going around. You know? The poor guy will become rich, the rich guy will become poor. Yes?
What happens if you use the facility right, then you get... you do the austerity, you get the facility, but you don't accept the facility.
And why wouldn't you accept the facility?
Well, you just don't want to. Does the credit remain, or does it go somewhere else?
The point is you've gotten the facility. That what did you do with that facility?
You just rejected it.
Rejected it, so, but the point is what's the, what does that form of rejection look like? You just neglect it, you gave it away, you sold it. No, but there's a difference. You know what I'm saying? It's like this. I get facility, then I don't want it, okay? Then we'll go into wanting or not wanting after. So I get the facility, I don't want it, and so then I see that someone who can use that properly gets it. Okay, now if I've given it to a qualified person, I get the credit for that charity, right? But now if I have it and neglect it, but it's my responsibility, I'm not taking care of it. So in the future, you'll lose the facility to have that. You understand?
So you still have to accept.
Means the point is it's come to you, it's yours. You have to, therefore, you're responsible to do something proper with it. Now, if you're not wanting it because of the trouble it is, that's the mode of passion. If you're not wanting it because you don't require it, then that'll be mode of goodness. You know, mode of ignorance, you can't tell what's worth having or what's not having. You know, then that's going to be trouble. But there's also the element is, can it be used in Krishna's service? So then you engage it in that way. Either you engage it yourself or give it to those who can engage it. You know what I'm saying? Let's say you get a house, but you don't want the house. So you then you can, you know, make the facility the devotees can use it, or turning it into a preaching thing, or others who can like that. Does that make sense? Then that means you get the best benefit. Otherwise, then someone who actually needs a place, they don't have a place, you give it to them, or let them use it, or, you know, something. But if you just neglect it and it falls apart, then in the future you won't have. Like that, that's it. Because the point is, the karma is your karma. But the point is you don't make the laws. So it's not, it's mine, I can do with whatever I want. No, it's your quota, you deal with the quota properly, it's that you get properly. Just like the parent gives the child an allowance, they use the allowance nicely, they continue to get the allowance. They use it badly, they lose the allowance. You could say, but it's my allowance, I can do whatever you want. No, but it actually belongs to someone else. It's just your quota. Like that. Okay. Therefore, tapas is not to be understood as self-torture. The Bhagavad Gita clearly states that yoga is not for one who indulges the flesh, nor for one who tortures it. Right? Because you can't be a yogi if it's either way. Mm-hmm. One who is a real yogi enthusiastically takes up a life of healthy asceticism. He may thus gradually unlock mystical powers within himself. By these powers, the yogi is able to easily withstand intense cold or go for long periods of time without eating, drinking, or even breathing. But until such powers are unlocked, it is useless to try to imitate the accomplishments of tapas. Actually, supernatural powers are not the goal of tapas. The real goal is the development of a sincere enthusiasm for a life of austerity. And austerity just means...
Oh, a bee?
Yeah.
Well, he's ended up over there now. He was over there.
It fell down, heading for your arm.
Oh, okay. Okay, so in other words, it's a life of austerity. Austerity means what's the performance of your duty. So whatever your position, the natural lifestyle that goes with that, that's what you should be doing. So that's what the actual purpose of tapasya is. Swadhyaya. Swadhyaya includes studying the scriptures, hearing from saints and sages, and observing the lessons of experience through the eyes of spiritual revelation. Proper swadhyaya requires discrimination, which means neither blind acceptance nor critical analysis of the sources of knowledge. Right? This idea of critical analysis sounds good because critical analysis means that analysis is good, so it's intellectual analysis. No, it's critical analysis. It means you're trying to find the faults. Mm. Right, it's a different thing. Why do they use the term critical analysis? Right, but because analysis is there, it becomes euphemized, so you think it's nice. You know, so that's the ideas that your means submissive inquiry. You're not blindly accepting. You know why, but at the same time, it's because critical analysis means it's open. Anything could be right. No, this is correct. How is it correct? How does it apply in my life? You know, why are we doing it? What's the importance? What's the benefit? These are the ways it's approached, not whether it's correct or not. And it's up to you to decide. Mm. Right?
So critical is just an expression of ignorance.
Basically, yeah, because critical analysis is, you know, in other words, critical is the ignorance and analysis is the passion.
Oh, yeah.
So what we're missing here is the goodness.
It seems to always be like that.
Yeah, no, it seems to be like that. One should glean the essence of the transcendental teachings and utilize the essence for practical advancement, right? So you study, you get the essence, then utilize that essence to practically apply it and advance. That's what one's trying to do, right? Not just to know, like you were saying, but just learn knowledge so you can know more knowledge and so you can, we can more quickly in the morning, someone was saying.
Processing information.
That we simply, the point of the modern academy is that we find better and better ways to process information. But it's not that they ever use the information. Right? Because then that would be, that wouldn't be fun. Right?
Then we would have to leave the campus.
Yes. You have to go, yeah. Without discrimination, one may become confused by the apparent contradictions among different teachings from various scriptures and authorities. Therefore, proper study is a skill that must be learned from one who has mastered the scriptures. Right. So that's what Rupa Goswami says, is you approach the scriptures and the previous acharyas through your acharya. Right. So how Prabhupada presents in his books is how we approach all the other literatures and all the other writings in the acharyas. Does that make sense? So then that works. So that's why it must be learned from those who have mastered the scriptures. Right? So that's study. Right? Study includes studying the scriptures, hearing from saints and sages, and observing the lessons of experience through the eyes of spiritual revelation, right? So Shastra Chakshus. What the Shastra says is how we view it, but the Shastras come to us from the Acharyas. Right? Ishvara Paridhana. Pranidhana. Surrender to the Supreme Being is the best method for protecting oneself from the dangers of attachment, false identification, the idea of I am the doer. Right? Surrender is possible through cultivation of faith and devotion to the Lord within the heart. So even they've figured it out. Even if their purpose is is liberation, they figured out the best way to get rid of all these material difficulties is surrender to the Lord.
Right? Interesting. Interesting that they don't see that as the ultimate goal then.
No, because the thing is you see this is in the beginning here. This is Niyama, right? So Niyama is the second of five.
Yes.
So it's early in the process when they're going through it.
Mm.
So when it's being explained, then when we get the idea that it is about surrendering to the Lord and that absorption in the Lord. But when it gets to the end of the book, it doesn't talk about that.
Mm.
So that's the difficulty, is that it's only being used as a method. Therefore, you can't say they're devotees. But yoga is meant to, you have to connect to the Supreme. So you could do that with the idea of that eternal relationship. Then one's a devotee. Right? So one could practice yoga, Ashtanga yoga, as a devotional process. We see in the Bhagavatam, many have. But, as we said, you know, just set aside 36,000 years and hey, you know, it works. Like that, you know. Ten if it's quick, you know. But I wonder if there was some combination there, because the Pachetas did that for 10,000 years, but there was 10 of them.
Yeah.
So if that there was some combined, you know, like that.
Huh?
Yeah, it could be accumulated, or you know, okay, you do the yama, you do the niyama, you like that.
Like some kirtan.
Yeah. So somehow all together, then it's like that. I don't know. But they did it in 10,000. But you ever hear of others? I think it's Atri or someone. It's 60,000. You know, so you live 100,000, so 60,000.
What about Dhruva?
Huh?
Dhruva, he did it in half a year?
Yeah, six months. Yeah. I mean, look at his guru.
Very determined.
Narad Muni.
What about the They have the same one.
After. Isn't it? Didn't they come out and then he came? Afterwards or before?
No, he gave them the first instructions.
Before and then
Narad Muni.
Yeah, but that was after they came out of the water, then Narad Muni.
Yeah.
But here it's Narad Muni in the beginning. But maybe also as a kid, so not much to think about, right? You know, how many toys can you think about, right? So. But his focus was very, very great. But they were also kings. He was a king, but he was an insulted king. So then that may seem to have intensified it. So. But that's the point. It can't be done that quickly. So if you're working on that, then... But the point is he also stopped the breathing process, I think, after a couple of months also.
Yeah.
You know, he only lived off those little red berries for a little while and then stopped doing that, so... We can try. Still working on those ones. Okay. Yeah, contentment. Okay. Okay.
So the yoga process and the smarta, they get weak because they put the Lord in Abhidaya and not in Prayojana.
Yes, because the Lord's in Abhidaya and not Prayojana. Because the point is the Lord is Sambandha, he is Abhidaya, he is Prayojana. But the problem is they don't keep him in Prayojana, like that. So that's why it's not nitya. So if he's the goal, then and because he's always there, then it's something that's always continuing. So then it becomes. Okay, so surrender is possible through cultivation of faith and devotion to the Lord within the heart. Footnote 15. Nonetheless, the Lord does not play a prominent role in the yoga philosophy. In the purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 10.87.25, it is stated, Patanjali's yoga method is here called asat because it ignores the essential aspect of devotion. surrender to the will of the Supreme Person, right? They've surrendered to the Lord, that he will take care of this, but not to the will of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Understand? Because the will means the person, right? Means he's in control of the thing, so we surrender to him, he'll control it the way we want, right? But here it's a matter of you surrender the will of the Lord, that means he controls it the way he wants, so we get engaged according to how he wants. It's a difference. So that's the difference between the devotee and that. Got a question? No? Okay. Just trying to work out the different tells. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 17:28, anything done as sacrifice, charity, or penance without faith in the Supreme, O son of Prita, is impermanent. It is called asat, and it is useless both in this life and in the next. Because right? Useful means it takes you back to Godhead. Right? You develop love for Krishna. That's useful. If it doesn't do that, it's actually asat. You may get some little benefits and all that, like the yogi, you probably get very good health, like that, you know, a peaceful mind, these things like that. But he still is not going to develop God consciousness. So in the future, he's naturally going to become unsettled. Like that. Because how long can you just go on being just peaceful? You know, you want some variety. So then, right. The Yoga Sutras acknowledge the Supreme the personality of Godhead in an oblique way, but only as a helper whom the advancing yogi can utilize. Ishwaratma Pranidhana Dhanadva. Devotional meditation on God is yet another means of achieving concentration. Yoga Sutra 123. In contrast, Bhadarayana Vyasadeva's philosophy of Vedanta emphasizes devotional service not only as the primary means to liberation, but also as identical with liberation itself. A pranayat, tatapi hi drishtam. Worship of the Lord continues up to the point of liberation, and indeed goes on in the liberated state also, as the Vedas reveal. Vedanta Sutra 4.1.12. Right? Yeah, so fourth means the prayojana part. Asana. Posture. Okay, is that clear? In other words, they only use concentrating on the Lord as a process, because of all the processes you could use, anything connected to the Lord is always going to be more, give better effect than anything that's not. Right? So anything on the mundane platform is going to do, whether it's in karma or jnana, you get a better result if you connect it to the Lord. So they understand this, so they're using it just for their material purpose, rather than looking at it, if everything works better connected to the Lord, then that means connection to the Lord is the specialness. Right? Not that I get what I want. You know, why would so many varieties of endeavor, so many varieties of knowledge, you know, to get so many varieties of results, if it's connected to the Lord, it works so much better. That means the Lord is the central feature. So why wouldn't that be special? But they don't catch that, right? Because of the material desire. So they're not able to appreciate. Okay. Asana, posture. Asanas, physical postures, ensure physical health and mental harmony. They're used in conjunction with the yamas and niyamas and the other limbs of Patanjali Yoga. For without the other elements of the system, mere physical exercise cannot provide the desired benefits. Nowadays, because many so-called students of yoga do not understand the importance of mastering the yamas and niyamas before attempting the asanas, the yogic postures have largely degenerated into mere physical culture. The yoga asanas are not means of improving physical beauty, but are important prerequisites for the attainment of the higher goals of this yoga system. The highest aim of yoga is to attain samadhi. The meditative postures enable one to sit comfortably and steadily for a long time, with the head, neck, and trunk properly aligned so that breathing may be regulated. The mind may be withdrawn from the senses. The mind may be concentrated within. And samadhi, unbroken trance, may at last be attained. Strange. I'm not sure where, but it's starting to break into a New York accent from reading. The postures are broadly divided into two major categories: postures for physical well-being and postures for meditation. Right? Because if the physical well-being is not there, then you can't sit and meditate. Right? So therefore, they do both of these. They make the body physically strong, and they create that peacefulness of the mind. The commentators in Patanjali Sutras mention only a few postures that are helpful in meditation. But later yoga scriptures describe a complete science of postures for physical and mental well-being. There are 84 classical postures, but only four of these are suggested for the practice of meditation. These are Sukhasana, the easy pose, Swastikasana, the auspicious pose, Padmasana, the lotus pose, and Siddhasana, the accomplished pose. In all meditative postures, the emphasis is on keeping the head, neck, and trunk straight. The spine, being thus aligned, provides steadiness and comfort in the posture and minimizes the consumption of oxygen. So all these are just variations on the lotus. It's just where one of the feet is placed, basically. It's whether they're both up on the thighs, or one's on the thigh and one's not, or they're both in between like that. It's basically it's all you're doing. So that's these four are suggested. Those 84 classical, but then of that there's 32 main. Right? So you have like that. That's basically what they have. But there's technically 8,400,000 asanas, one for each species of life. So I'm not sure what the Ebola, asan looks like or something like that. But there is one. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
All right. If asan brings all these benefits, right?
Sorry?
If the asan brings these benefits and we spend so much time, why don't we study more how to do it? Because the book is usually, I'm always on the side with my spine out of line.
Yeah, but then the problem is then they turn into yogis, not devotees. Because then it's all times is this and that, and then it's, don't eat this, don't eat that, don't do this, don't do that, and after a while you can't do anything. So if you're going to ritualize yourself, then that's why we use Pancharatra. Pancharatra is a better, more septic way of ritualizing, because it's a kindness directly connected to the deity. While all these other ritual things are not connected with the deity. That's the problem.
So we could use it as a tool.
It can be, but the thing is then you have to know, and then the element of the false ego and all these things come in. Because generally those who do asanas, they generally have a little bit of a pride that they're better at things, they're more healthy, and so many things like that. But then, physically, yes, but the problem is as pointed out before by the author here, is that these elements of yama and niyama, ahimsa, satya, sense control, non-possessiveness, purity, contentment, austerity, study, and surrender, that they don't do. Because if you actually want to be a proper yogi, you want to increase your study, increase your purity. But they do yoga sans, but their house is no cleaner. They're no less attached, they're no more austere, they're no more contented. They're just as political and gossipy, and you understand. So technically the benefits from the asanas that they're looking for they'll never get, because anxiety is also a cause of disease. You know what I'm saying? And generally you find much of the time those who are into yoga totally for health and really into it, like any other kind of health freak, is they're the least healthy people. Why? Because they're always in anxiety. Right? Like that. They may be eating nicely, sitting nicely, doing everything, but they're in anxiety. While the guy is more relaxed and happy-go-lucky, he never gets sick. Why? There's no anxiety. So that they somehow know they get left out. So it's nice, but the point is you have every day you have an hour, 45 minutes to practice your asanas in Bhagavatam class, or another hour when you chant japa, but nobody does, I mean, they're of course doing the dynamics of the, a combination, basically of, what do you call it? What is this? Yoga mudra, I think, yeah. You sit like this, and then you go forward like this. And back, and then you go forward like this. Like that. So devotees do a lot of practice in yoga mudra. Like that. That's kind of...
You might even say they can do it in their sleep.
Yeah, they're so good at it, they can do it in their sleep, yeah. Okay, so then we'll continue on Thursday, yeah? With pranayama. Okay. Oh, okay. Then it gets right into the heirs, what they do. Okay. Oh, okay. Cool. Get the whole thing. Okay. Very good.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Sarva Veta Bhakti Vrinda ki, Chaitanya Jai Gaura Prabhupada ki.